PWT is looking for a full-time sales and administrative coordinator. The sales and administrative coordinator is responsible for the sale of on-air advertisements and co-presentation partnerships, as well as the negotiating of the radio station's administrative contractual agreements. The ideal candidate will have a passion for community radio, the ability to work with volunteers, clients, and community members, is well-organized, and has strong negotiating skills. We are looking for someone with knowledge of Montreal's arts, culture, and activity scenes who sees media as a tool for building community and can work in a non-hierarchical organization. Financial literacy, bilingualism, and experience with Google Suite products are also a requirement. For full details about the position, wage, and benefits, please visit ckut.ca. The cutoff for applications is Monday, February 6th at 5 p.m. CKUT strives to be a progressive working environment and recognizes experience outside of the formal workplace as important qualifications. We value the unique contributions that individuals from traditionally underrepresented and oppressed communities bring to our organization and encourage these individuals to apply.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Is Canadian media biased towards Israel and against Palestinians? It certainly feels that way to those of us who are following the news coverage, but how should we understand this bias and where does it come from? Today, we'll be joined by Davide Mastracci, who has written a new book chapter on this topic. We'll talk about the role of journalists, editors, news owners, and lobby groups in pushing media coverage to be favorable to Israel and how these factors undermine reporting on Israel's human rights abuses. My name is Michael Buechert, Vice President of CJPME and the podcast host for today. With me is Tom Woodley, CJPME president and our podcast co-host. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, Michael. Great to be here and looking forward to our discussion together.
And we are very honored to be joined by Davide Mastracci, who is the managing editor at Passage, a Canadian publication of thoughtful political, economic, and cultural ideas from a left-wing perspective. His writings have been published in Al Jazeera, the Electronic Intifada, and Canada Land. He is the author of a chapter titled Canadian Media and Pro-Israel Bias, An Insider's Perspective, which is part of the book Advocating for Palestine in Canada, published this year by Fernwood, which I co-edited. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Really great to have you on. When we included your chapter in the book, I was really excited because I think a lot of us are aware that bias is happening, but you do a great job of really breaking down where it comes from, the different agents of that, and some of the implications. So really excited to talk to you about it. And so I guess that's kind of my first question. You know, I think a lot of us have a sense of what bias is, but what does it actually look like? What are we talking about when we talk about pro-Israel bias in Canadian media? Maybe if there's, how would you describe it? And maybe are there some key examples that you would often point to when you talk about it?
Yeah, for sure. First, I'll say that the book chapter that I wrote was originally published at Passage, and working at an independent leftist place has allowed me to sort of do reporting on media bias, pro-Israel media bias. And if I didn't work at this sort of place, I wouldn't even be able to put this sort of work out. So it's very pervasive. So I'm glad that Passage exists for that. But in terms of what the pro-Israel bias looks like in Canadian media, it encompasses a lot of different things. So some of it looks like what stories the media does and doesn't publish about Israel, what is left out and included in the articles that they do publish, who they speak to for those articles, so what sort of sources they use, how they frame the stories, how they portray Palestinians, what sort of stances their editorial boards take on Israel's occupation of Palestine, the sort of opinion articles that they choose, so what opinions they represent and how many of them get published, what groups, what sort of lobby groups they actually care about and respond to pressure from, how they treat employees that are pro-Palestine or get, you know, perceived as pro-Palestine, anti-Palestinian racism in newsrooms, what journalism advocacy groups focus on. There's really just like an endless number of ways that the bias sort of manifests themselves. So it can't just be, you know, reduced to one or two ways or one or two examples. So I have some, you know, there are some like examples of all of the things that I mentioned, right? So in terms of what the media does or doesn't report on, we often see that they won't report on bad things that Israel has done or reports about bad things that Israel has done. So we saw this with the lack of media coverage on reports that found Israel guilty of apartheid, which have existed for a long time. But in the past couple of years, there's been a bunch of them from organizations that the media would typically take seriously and report on their findings. So the fact that they didn't report on these particular findings could be seen as bias. You can see it, for example, in their stories on Israel. They'll often talk to pro-Israel sources, whether it's like actual government officials or members of lobby groups. They may not talk to critical voices at all. And if they do, they'll be pushed to like the very, you know, bottom of the article with maybe one or two graphs, whereas the pro-Israel voices will get the whole thing. So that's an example of the bias. You see it in the framing of Israel as like a good force that's just trying to defend itself from Palestinian aggressors. And that's not a description of reality. It's a particular framing that indicates bias, and they take it up all the time. So you can see it in the sort of racist and Islamophobic tropes that they describe Palestinians with in their articles. I mentioned earlier the editorials, and that's a really prominent one. Basically, every time Israel has attacked Gaza, Canadian editorial boards who put out articles that are supposed to represent like the official position of the paper have almost always cheered on those attacks. And this is like from the National Post all the way to like the Toronto Star. So it's pretty widespread. And then that extends to the sort of opinion articles they publish too. You'll see a lot from pro-Israel voices, and then they might just completely ignore pro-Palestinians and definitely Palestinians themselves. Or if they do get in, they might get kind of one article that is very, very heavily edited. And then I mentioned earlier lobby groups. You see newspapers taking Israel lobby groups very seriously. They listen to what they say. They'll have meetings with them. They often react to kind of what they demand, whereas they'll often ignore Palestinians. And this isn't because of the validity of their complaints or concerns, but comes down to the bias. And then also, like I mentioned earlier, we've seen a lot of employees over the years either be fired, demoted, or taken off coverage for just being accused of supporting Palestine in some way, even if that's not exactly the case. So, you know, there's kind of endless examples of all of these things that exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we certainly noticed a lot of those. And, you know, these things are very pervasive. They're very widespread, but they're also, a lot of them are kind of subtle, in that it might not be obvious from looking at one or two articles, but only sort of looking over time at a pattern. I think that these things sort of even become recognizable. Something that lots of people might be familiar with that is more hard or like obvious is when a couple of years ago, the CBC, a radio journalist had to apologize when he said the word Palestine on air. Obviously that's absurd, but I think you've actually done some digging into that, and it's kind of a widespread policy not to use the word Palestine. Is that the case?
Yeah, 100%. It's basically an editorial policy that the CBC 100% has adopted, and other publications have kind of informally adopted. And so the CBC did rightfully get a lot of slack for making that change to their program and forcing the reporter to apologize on air. But like you said, it's all about the trend. So a lot of other publications have done the exact same thing, and they've kind of just avoided scrutiny because people may not notice it. So it's 100% all about the sort of the trends and the patterns.
Yeah. Well, David, I think probably some of our listeners are curious, like what actually got you interested in this in the first place? I know in your chapter in the book, you talk about one of your earliest experiences as a journalist was, well, not the earliest, but when you were a young journalist and doing some coverage and you had a story about Palestine and that was your first personal experience. But did you have an interest in this even before that happened? And what sort of galvanized generally your interest in this topic?
Yeah, I started doing journalism in my undergrad at McGill. So that was from like 2010 to 2014. And I was writing for one of the student papers there, the McGill Daily. And just being in that environment, writing for the paper, being involved with sort of activism on campus, I learned a lot about Palestine and what was going on. And I was interested in the media, so I learned more about the bias against Palestine and Palestinians in the media. And with my journalism, I've always tried to fill in gaps in what exists so that I can be putting out useful stuff. And I felt like there wasn't enough criticism of the media for the bias against Palestinians. So I felt like it would be worthwhile to try to address that. And that's kind of how it started all the way back then. But yeah, the past maybe 4 years or so, I've put a lot more effort into it and made that much more of a focus of my work, as well as I've just focused more on media criticism in general.
I think as well for our audience, let's just sort of take a step back as well. I mean, it may seem obvious, but what actually are the consequences of having this pro-Israel media bias in our society? Does it matter? Should we just accept that it's going to happen? Or, what really are the consequences in your opinion?
Yeah, I would say a major consequence is that the Canadian public remains either underinformed or misinformed about what's going on, particularly if they rely on mainstream media coverage, which might be, you know, less true now, but certainly was true in the past. And if they're underinformed or misinformed, I think they're, you know, less likely to take part in pro-Palestine action. So whether that's activism, whether that's donating, whether that's factoring politicians' position on Palestine into who they vote for, they're less likely to do all of that if they have no idea of what's going on. And I think that this can result in sort of pressure being taken off politicians, either, you know, pressure in the forms of votes or protests or activism. And so they're more easily allowed to go on with the status quo, which is a pro-Israel one. So I think there are, that's sort of like a top level consequence of the bias. And there are kind of, you know, many others, but that's a top level one. And then it, in terms of whether like it matters or not, and, you know, whether we should accept it, it's a bit of a mix of both, to be honest. I think we absolutely have to fight to, you know, reduce or erase the bias in mainstream media. But at the same time, we can't rely on mainstream media. And it's really important for us to build and kind of support our own outlets that lets us sort of get around the mainstream media and get the truth out, get good journalism out, because we're in a position where we don't have to rely on them as much now. So I think it's a mix of, you know, fighting for reforms to the media that exists and then creating our own so that we don't have to rely on them.
Yeah. You know, and as I was listening to you and listening to you describe the impacts, you also think about, you look at how the mainstream media has covered Ukraine and how the very intense coverage and very favorable coverage of the Ukrainian resistance has influenced our society very favorably towards Ukraine. And it's almost like an inverse example of, you know, when the media responds one way versus another way.
Yeah, 100%. It can definitely have an impact on how people feel about ongoing issues. I mean, as a journalist, I hope that's true. Maybe it's less so than before, but I would like to think it has some impact. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons your chapter is really interesting, I think, is because you are writing from your own professional experience to an extent as a journalist in the industry with your own experience. And your chapter includes a few personal examples of when you faced some kind of pushback in different ways for writing about Palestine. Can you tell us about some of those instances and how maybe they shaped your perspective on this?
Yeah, sure. So I've written and kind of, you know, either interned or, you know, done small things at a bunch of places, but I don't have a ton of experience working at sort of mainstream major news organizations. So all of these examples are from like the one little bit of experience, a year or so of experience I did have working at like a well-known digital place that's sort of known for being progressive, which I think makes what happens more interesting because it's not just sort of right-wing or conservative places where this happens. And I also will say that these examples are pretty mild compared to what other people have faced or do face, but you know, they're still interesting anyways, I think, and they've definitely impacted how I look at the industry. So there's a few examples. The first was that sort of shortly after arriving at this publication, I wrote an article about Palestine. I can't remember the exact focus of it, but my sort of immediate editor accepted it. We published it and, you know, good attention, good traffic, whatever. But the next day, a more senior editor talked to me and told me that the junior editor shouldn't have published it without running it by them because they weren't sure of their position on Israel-Palestine, as they called it. So they said that in the future, I should consult with them before publishing anything on it. And so even though I was still fresh, you know, very new to the job, this to me kind of immediately told me, okay, they have a bias on this issue. And maybe they're sort of hinting like, hey, you shouldn't write on this in the future, especially if that's something that they wouldn't do for other media topics, which ended up being mostly true. They were a lot more laid back on other topics. So another time, this was a bit later, So I wrote another critical article. I mean, I didn't really take the warning seriously. I just kept trying to do what I wanted to do anyways. So I wrote another piece. This one was on media bias on Palestine. And this one seems kind of petty, but, you know, it's important. The social media editor, whose job is to, you know, get the articles that the journalists would write in front of a lot of eyes, get people to read it, scheduled this article for just before midnight on a Friday, even though the article had been done much, much earlier in the day, which basically means, you know, we're pushing it out when nobody is going to see it because people have better things to do. Right. And so this was very strange. This wasn't like a usual practice at the publication or really anywhere. So I asked a couple other people who worked there, and they actually told me that the person who had scheduled this had interfered with other people's work regarding Israel before and was a Zionist. So it was like basically guaranteed that they did this on purpose. And then, you know, as the months went on at this publication, I found that that was the case. I had more issues with this person. The next couple are a bit more serious, I would say. Another time in the future, I got invited onto a radio show to talk about an article I had written that had to do with Palestine. And at this media company, if we wanted to do outside media appearances, we had to get approval. So just kind of, hey, this is what I want to talk about. This is where can I do it? And I had done them in the past on other issues before, and usually I would just get a quick yes, like, awesome, go talk about it, let us know how it goes. But this time I didn't hear answer for days, and I had to keep following up. And eventually I got called into a meeting with multiple people where they gave me a very bizarre answer and said that I could go on the show if I wanted, but I couldn't give my opinion. I only had to describe things in objective terms, and this was because they weren't sure what their stance on the issue was because it was complicated. Mm-hmm. And so this was very bizarre because I wasn't working at this place as a news reporter. I was working as an opinion writer and editor.
But you can't talk about your opinion.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was just kind of a crafty way of basically telling me, no, you can't do it, because my job was to give opinions. And I had gone on the radio before and given them about, you know, things that I think that they would also find controversial, but they didn't hold me back there. They just did in this particular case. So I ended up not doing this appearance. That one was pretty bizarre. And then right toward the end of my time at this place, I had tweeted some mild criticism of an Israeli official. Didn't really get any attention, like a couple likes, moved on with my life. And then a few days later, I got a phone call from somebody much higher up in the company asking me to remove the tweet because somebody had complained about it. They wouldn't tell me who it was, if it was within the company. And when I tried to ask them what the issue with the tweet was, they obviously didn't really understand. Like, they weren't the ones asking. They didn't really get what the issue was. But regardless, they asked me to remove the tweet, and they said that I needed to remove that I worked for the company from my Twitter bio because I was a contractor. Even though they hadn't asked other contractors to do the same and they had never asked me before. So to me, this was a very clear, you know, you're in trouble here. And that was near the end of my time at the company, which was already scheduled. So I'm not saying the two things are related, but who knows?
Yeah, what's interesting is that it's a lot of, as you say, sort of relatively minor instances, and yet all of them would sort of dissuade someone from writing about this issue in the future. If, like, you know, you have to run it by someone first, no one's going to see your content, you can't talk about it, about your opinion with anyone. All of these things, I feel like, would kind of add up and sort of discourage one from choosing to write on that, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I definitely factored that into what I thought about writing. I don't think I ended up self-censoring, but it definitely was a factor in my article selection process in a way that it absolutely is not now with Passage, where I just, you know, write whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at this place, it was always kind of weighing on me. And I know that with other people, who had worked there in the past, it had convinced them with their own experiences just to not bother, just to leave it alone, which I can understand.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to sort of go through some of the different actors in the journalism industry and outside who play a role, who you sort of discussed their role in terms of pro-Israel media bias. And I'm wondering if there's much to say about journalists and whether journalists are perpetuating that problem. Do you think that most journalists are biased, or is that not the issue?
I think that journalists often write biased stories or make biased editorial decisions. I think a lot of them, most of them aren't like active Zionists. They might not have a strong position on Israel, on Palestine. A lot of them might be misinformed and don't do the work to inform themselves. Some of them might not be biased, but might just be, I guess, too scared to kind of speak up. So I do think that they play some role, but ultimately, whether they're biased on sort of a personal level doesn't necessarily matter if they aren't doing work to challenge that. And when you look at the structure that they fit in, you know, the blame is not fully on them, but I do think some journalists absolutely are biased and deserve blame for that. And a lot of journalists want to avoid personal accountability, so they shouldn't. And so that's like individual journalists. And then in terms of like editorial boards, you know, which I said are like supposed to represent the official positions of papers, even though they often don't, in the sense that, like, if I worked at the National Post, let's say, and they put out an editorial, you know, that wouldn't represent my opinion. But in theory, they're supposed to represent the official positions of newspapers. In terms of those journalists, 100%, they all seem pretty biased. And I say that just based on the track record of stuff they've put out over the years, where they have free reign to say, you know, to articulate a position for the paper, and it always leans one way. So it's a much kind of clearer case for those particular journalists.
Yeah, and your article does kind of go through one example of that, where you look at editorial support for Israel's military offensives in Gaza over the years, giving total support to Israel in spite of the evidence of severe atrocities. And so it's useful to see that. And I mean, I think you've demonstrated this kind of editorial consensus on a lot of different issues over the years in terms of support for war, military intervention overseas, and that kind of thing. So it's not surprising to see this as one of those issues in which at the editorial level, there's very little diversity of opinion, I guess. And maybe part of the problem is this other aspect which you talk about, which is the role of corporate interference. That is how the owners of media companies and news chains might use the news to pursue their own personal political agendas, including on the issue of Israel, but not exclusively. And so you actually give the example of the CanWest news chain, and Tom mentioned it earlier, Israel Asper, who was the head of that, especially in the early 2000s, you know, and the ownership of this chain significantly interfered in editorial choices, even news coverage, to make sure that it was a steadfastly pro-Israel perspective. Can you tell us about what happened there? Can you speak a little bit about Israel Asper, maybe?
Yeah, 100%. The examples at Ken West, I actually learned quite a bit about when I was writing this article. I think I had originally intended for the article to have a much narrower focus, but then I discovered one fact and looked deeper and found another one and found another one. And this part of the article was especially shocking to me because it was maybe the most blatant and egregious form of the bias in action. You know, a lot of them will be more subtle, but this was kind of as straightforward as you can get. So as you mentioned, Israel Asper, people called him Izzy, was owned Ken West, which was a newspaper chain, started in, I think, the mid-70s. He was a very open Zionist. In my article, I quoted about how he has talked about having a, or how he had talked about having a unshakable commitment to Israel. And he said that it was a symbol and teacher of excellence for all humankind. So he was very intense. Over the decades, his media chain grew. And in 2000, Ken West published a huge amount of papers. So at that point, they had, I think, over like 140 papers, a mix of daily papers, weekly papers. And these are some of the major papers that we, you know, still turn to now. So like The Post, The Calgary Herald, Edmonton Journal, Montreal Gazette, Ottawa Citizen, Vancouver Sun, Vancouver Province. That chain owned all these papers before Post Media came around later. So what decisions this chain made had a huge impact on Canadian media as a whole during this period. And so Asper basically used the paper as a way to spread his pro-Israel views. And he was very open and clear about that. So I found in my article that in October 2002, he was talking to the Israel Bonds Gala, and he sort of talked about how he thought that Canadian media had, quote, destroyed the world's favorable disposition toward Israel. He said that most journalists, including the ones at his publications, were, quote, lazy or sloppy or stupid or biased or anti-Semitic. And he said basically that Canadians have a duty to stand tall for the right of Israel to exist and to take whatever actions it needs to battle its savage attackers and to demand that our media and our politicians act with honor in this quest. So that's what he said around the time. And he used his papers, yeah, very, very blatant. And he used his papers basically to achieve this goal, which a lot of, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of owners do, and for, you know, a variety of causes. But for him, this one was especially important. So in my article, I kind of looked at a bunch of examples from that period. So kind of from the first couple of years of the 2000s, where that interference happened. So I guess I can just list sort of a few of them.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Just to give, you know, listeners an idea. So I'm just going to have to look at the article for this one. There's a lot of details. So in September 2001, the publisher of the Montreal Gazette, he quit his position. And this, the Globe and Mail reported that this was because senior editors at the paper had been told the month before that they had to run a pro-Israel editorial, very strongly pro-Israel editorial. So he quit because of that, which is interesting because it's, you know, really difficult to imagine someone taking that sort of stance today. A few months later, an investigative reporter at the Montreal Gazette talked about sort of a protest that reporters at the publication were doing at the time, which is that they were pulling their bylines from articles. And they had done that because of Ken West basically imposing chain-wide editorials on their papers. So the editor-in-chief of the chain would come up with these editorials. A lot of them were pro-Israel editorials. They would force the papers, all of the papers in the chain, or most of them in the chain, to run them, which was more, you know, controversial at the time. It's pretty standard now, but at the time it was still, you know, this is something new. This is not good. And, you know, the guy that went on the radio to talk about this, Bill Marsden, he talked explicitly about how, you know, they used to have more wide-ranging pieces, coverage of Israel. But since these changes were forced, that debate was basically shut down. They had to quit those sort of articles. And they asked the editor-in-chief at the time, just CBC asked him, you know, if there was an editorial on Israel that was a bit different from the chain's position, would they be able to publish that? And he explicitly said no. And so around the same time, there was another example from the Gazette where a TV critic wrote about a CBC documentary that criticized Israel for its treatment of Palestinian journalists. So this has obviously been a long-running issue. And so initially the editors held the column. So she had submitted it and that they held it from being published. She filed a union grievance to try to get it published, which is an interesting approach. And they did eventually publish it, but they made major, major changes for this review to be published. So she quit her job as a result of that out of protest, which again is really commendable, and it's hard to imagine sort of happening now. And she also told reporters at the time, you know, usually we can criticize what we want. This is not normal for our paper. There's a bunch of others that happened at other publications in the chain. So one interesting one was in January 2002. Doug Cuthand, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name, but he was an indigenous columnist for a couple of the Ken West papers. And he wrote a column sympathizing with Palestinians, sort of drawing comparisons between indigenous people here and Palestinians, which is pretty standard now, of course, and is a very valid point. And his article got killed. He wasn't allowed to publish it. And he said that was the first time it had happened in 10 years of writing for them. And yeah, there's other examples as well, including like at the Halifax Daily News. There was just tons of them. And I also found from a few years later on, so kind of like mid-2000s, people who worked at the Gazette or at other of Ken West publications at the time, just sort of talking about that era and saying just how barred they were from talking about Israel in any sort of critical way, and that it had been like nothing they had ever seen before or since in their long kind of careers, because these were pretty veteran journalists. So I found all of that, which I hadn't really known about it. I didn't know about that before I started this article. And that was super interesting just to see because of how blatant the bite was, but also just because of how some journalists actually kind of stood up against it in what I thought was a commendable way. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting how open everyone was talking about this problem. There was just one other example that I just wanted to ask you about, which is the issue of news wires. Because, I mean, all news organizations, lots of the main organizations will repackage or republish articles that are produced by these new wires, like Reuters and the Associated Press and that kind of thing. But there was an issue where Ken West was even rewriting those in a way that Reuters took issue with. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100%. So they were taking copy from Reuters and AP, and they had a policy to change words in these articles to fit their sort of ideological bias. So, for example, they would swap out the word rebel with terrorist, for example, and just kind of implement, like use the word terrorist in positions where the journalists originally did not. And this wasn't a one-time thing. It was a, you know, trend, the importance of the trends. And it got so bad that Reuters actually asked, or I guess forced Ken West to stop using their reporters' bylines when they republished these articles, because these changes had made the articles so, I guess, fundamentally different from what Reuters was intending with them. And it happened with the Associated Press as well. And these changes even led to them having to issue corrections, because their changes were not just neutral. They were not just, you know, fitting some sort of style guide. They were heavy in terms of ideological framing, which I talked about earlier. And these were on just straight news articles. The one other thing I should mention quickly, I found a really interesting study that was released in 2006 of the news coverage at the time, that was just sort of looking at all the news reporting and giving statistical analysis. And they found that the National Post was 83 times more likely to report an Israeli child's death than a Palestinian child's death in the headlines or first paragraphs of an article. And as a result, this is a quote, it made it appear that Israeli kids were killed at a rate 4 times higher than Palestinian children during 2004, when, in fact, 22 Palestinian children were killed for every Israeli child that year. So I think this is just a really great example of how the framing of stories or what they choose to emphasize can give a completely skewed version of what's actually happening.
I remember those days with Can West Media, and it was awful. And you saw that sort of blatant bias. CJPME was much smaller at the time and didn't nearly have the capacity to address it. But that's, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation here, that was, you're sort of going back and reviewing some of the just egregious things that happened under the ownership of Izzy Asper is just, it's a good reminder of how bad it can get. And even if it's not that bad everywhere, it does get very bad. And as we've mentioned, there are all these other subtle things that are happening as well. Let's move on, I guess, to one of the final major areas that we haven't yet touched on, which is also the role of pro-Israel lobby groups and how they've pressured journalists and editors to modify news coverage. You spend a bit of time in your chapter talking about an organization that calls itself Honest Reporting Canada. And if people could see me, I'm doing air quotes. In your book, you talk about them as HRC, and maybe in our conversation we can talk about them as HRC because I just hate repeating their name because it's so dishonest. Why don't you tell us a little bit about HRC and what they do and what they're able to, how they're able to sort of influence the media?
Sure. Yeah. HRC is an Israel lobby group founded in 2003. There are other groups with the same name for other parts of the world. They claim that they're not associated, but they share the same name and do effectively the same thing. So, you know, take that as you will. They started off as a nonprofit back then, but in 2019, they actually became a charity. And last year, they brought in $700,000 in revenue from donations, gifts from other charities. They've had endorsements from Israeli ambassadors and government figures. So they have a lot of resources. They've had a lot of official support. A lot of Israel lobby groups do focus on trying to impact media coverage, but for HRC, this is basically all they focus on. So they want to get media coverage that's what they see as being favorable to Israel. So the way that their group sort of works is that they do have some staff, and they also have a massive emailing list. They claim to have, I think, like 50,000 or 60,000 members. And between the staff and the members, they sort of scan media coverage. So they look for articles, videos, interviews. And when they see things that they think are biased or unfair, they'll kind of reach out to HRC, or if HRC sees it themselves, they'll act on it. And so when they act on it, they usually do a mix of two things. So one is that they'll reach out to contacts within those publications if they have them. They'll sort of lean on those contacts and, you know, portray the coverage as anti-Semitic. That's their typical tactic. And try to get the journalists, the editors, the managers at these publications to change the article, usually in a way that's much more favorable to Israel. Most of the time, these complaints aren't about any like factual errors. It's just a matter of interpretation.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the articles where they just sort of say, well, you're criticizing Israel, but you haven't talked about Hamas. You know, a lot of it is that sort of angle that you should have said this and you should have said that. And as you say, it's not actually about a factual sort of thing or misrepresentation. They're just sort of saying you should have said this and you should have said this bad thing about Hamas and Hamas and Hamas.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. So that makes up a lot of what their complaints are, just from my sort of anecdotal looking through what their complaints have been as I've been monitoring them and in the past. So they will reach out to these outlets. They do try to get specific stories changed. But then they also try to form sort of a relationship with the people who work at these publications, in part so that they can be sort of seen as a source on what Israel is doing, in part so that the journalists that work there will have them in the back of their mind when they're coming up with stories or when they're deciding who to talk to. So, you know, they can get one story changed by reaching out, but if they're also successful, they can get future stories, you know, killed before they come out or altered. So that's kind of the main thing that they do at the same time. So they'll do that in private, although they mentioned that they do have meetings, they do share it publicly, but they'll have these meetings in private. At the same time, they'll put out these sort of email blasts or social media blasts where they'll call out the individual journalists or the publications that they think have done something wrong. And they call on their massive email list to basically, you know, reach out and express your concern with this anti-Semitic story is sort of how they'll phrase it. And so that often results in those journalists, those publications getting flooded with emails, making it seem like they've done something horrendous. And so that mix of public pressure with sort of the private meetings that give the impression of, hey, if you just talk to us, we can get this to stop, are very effective at getting journalists to either make changes to the stories or, you know, to frame stories in certain ways in the future. So on their site, they talk about how they've gotten what they call corrections from more than 70 publications, most of them definitely more than once, like The Star, the CBC. They always seem to be putting out corrections related to HRC complaints. And so, yeah, they play a really important role in impacting what journalists do, because, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of journalists aren't necessarily like committed Zionists, probably very few are. A lot of them just don't want to get in trouble, try to avoid having public pressure put on them. And groups like HRC are very good at drumming up this, what seems like sort of public pressure, even if, let's say, the sort of pressure that comes from pro-Palestinians more accurately reflects public sentiment. Groups like HRC are very good at kind of conjuring up that image when they reach out to these publications. And I should just say also that the fact that this group exists and is very active, I don't want that to give the impression that the media is, you know, always putting out good stuff on Palestine, obviously. It's just more so a case of that the changes that they want are very extreme and they're always looking to push for more. So stuff that we would consider to be biased toward Israel, they would say, oh, well, I mean, they wouldn't frame it this way, but basically they would say it's not biased enough.
Yeah.
So one example I point out in some writing I've done on it is they have a glossary on their site where they talk about terms that they wanted the media to change. And one of them is that they want the media to call the West Bank Judea and Samaria instead, which is just nuts. Yeah. And sort of shows you what their ideological perspective is.
Yeah. 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 It really is extreme. And I sometimes put it, it's obviously has nothing to do with balance. It has more to do with pushing media coverage to be extremely pro-Israel. And I often think of HRC as being something, it's, if it's not flattering of Israel, it's not good enough, I think, from their perspective. Another thing we've talked to Jack Nagler with this. He's the CBC Ombudsman person, and he told us that articles on Israel-Palestine take more than 50% of his time. All the time that he spends, over 50% of it is on this one issue.
In terms of complaints against news
articles. Right, in terms of complaints or issues that are brought to the CBC. Exactly. And I believe it was him or it was he or someone else told me that part of the reason media outlets tend to be responsive to HRC is because HRC will often take them to the National News Media Council, meaning that HRC will then elevate these complaints of coverage to actually a journalistic association to which these various media outlets are members. So that was, I guess, one perspective on why the media are particularly more sensitive to HRC's complaints. But as we said earlier, quite often the complaints, it's really not about the coverage. It's about, you know, you didn't say this, or we shot, you should have said this. Or as you point out, Davida, you know, even the terminology that they want, and even a more extreme terminology, even if the terminology initially used in the article was quite standard or mainstream.
Well, they've even had campaigns against us just for an article quoted me on a topic. That'll be enough for an action alert campaign to try to get that removed from the news coverage. Right. So it's like any perspective, any narrative that could be even remotely sympathetic to Palestinians or just consistent with the international consensus on international law is unacceptable and has to be challenged. So, yeah, it's really far reaching.
Yeah. Davida, any thoughts or ideas in terms of things that Canadians themselves or Canadian Palestine solidarity groups could do to challenge this pro-Israel bias in our media?
So I guess it sort of connects back to what I said earlier about there's sort of two ways we can go about it. One is supporting independent media outlets that you feel do good work on this. They often need more resources. So if you can help them out in some way, to help provide them with more resources, they'll be able to reach sort of a broader audience, and this can really help. In terms of the mainstream, it's complicated. Some people try to focus on sort of educating journalists, editors, and that can have some impact because, as I said earlier, a lot of them aren't really committed Zionists. So in theory, sort of educating them could be useful. But at the same time, I mean, they could easily do this for themselves. The resources are out there. And, you know, if they don't have the convictions to sort of do anything with this knowledge, it might not make that much of a difference. Really, I think the main thing is to basically create a headache for journalists who run articles that are very biased toward Israel or articles that have a bias against Palestinians. Unfortunately, or you know, whatever, these tactics do work. There is a reason why HRC as a group uses them. And this does not mean we have to use dishonest tactics or, you know, but putting public pressure on these organizations does work because a lot of the times the journalists just want to avoid issues. And right now there's a lot of sort of the pro-Israel groups do this very well. Part of that is because, you know, they have a good amount of funding. They've been around for a long time. They've been doing it for a long time. So they're quite good at it. There are more pro-Palestinian groups doing this now. So whether it's like the group of people who were protesting the CBC, I think last year or maybe the year before, they've tried to put some public pressure on them. And obviously CJPME does that as well in a different sort of way. So I think really the public putting pressure on these organizations can help. The only thing there is that HRC is very good. And, you know, HRC and other Israel lobby groups are very good at putting very targeted pressure. So putting the pressure in areas where it will get results. So I think it's not just about sort of public outrage, because the public absolutely is more in line with pro-Palestinian views, but it's just a matter of sort of how do we direct this outrage in the right spots to get the best results. But then, yeah, ultimately, a lot of the change will also have to come from within journalism as well, due to like structural issues, ownership issues, issues with how journalists work and then not being able to hold themselves to account. So it's a wide ranging, you know, topic. I wish I knew exactly what the solution could be.
I think a lot of journalists, I mean, the surveys that we've done on Israel-Palestine, CJPME in the past, have always shown that the more someone is educated, the more they tend to be sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians and the human rights abuses that the Palestinians face. And of course, journalists tend to be very well-read, very informed people. And so I think we don't necessarily have to have the same game as HRC to compete with them, because journalists, I think, naturally see what's going on and naturally are inclined to write about the injustices and call out Israel for the injustices. So So we don't necessarily have to have the same numbers as HRC or have to work with the same intensity or bully as HRC does to have the same impact. So I think it's important to your point that, you know, that we give it our shot, that we, in as much as we might feel like, oh, well, my lone voice won't make any difference given what HRC is doing. But on the other hand, journalists know that's what we're saying, you know, is very, is really aligns with international law, human rights, general Canadian principles of justice. And so one letter can make a big difference, but it's important to have that first letter, that first email message to the journalist. Quite often we'll contact a politician who's spoken out on something or a journalist, and they'll say, you're the only email that I've received on this, and I've received X number from the other side. So I really like your point. It is important that, that people get involved in whatever way they can. So I'll, let it pass it over to Michael here.
Yeah, there were other things I wanted to get to, but we are running out of time. There's a lot more we could say. But before we go, I do want to give a shout out to your new newsletter called Now You Know, which actually looks at these issues, at the role of the pro-Israel groups like HRC in influencing Canadian media. Do you want to say a bit about why you decided to start this newsletter and what you've covered so far?
Sure, yeah. So the goal of the newsletter when I started it was just to provide examples of the Israel lobby interfering with Canadian media coverage sort of as they happen, so like an ongoing thing. I thought doing it as it happens is important because, one, it allows me to sort of bring up examples that might have otherwise been missed because, you know, a lot of other people might not be fixated on this sort of thing. So if I can bring these examples to public attention as they happen, and there's obviously a lot of other people working to do the same. I'm not the only one. But if together we can bring these examples to the public as they happen, maybe there'll be more public pressure around them. The other is sort of just to tie back to what I said earlier, basically just to demonstrate that it's a trend. You know, it's not the CBC making one bad decision every couple of years or isolated incidents. It's a trend. It's an ongoing thing. So the idea of the newsletter was just to sort of illustrate these things as they happen, to allow people to have a better understanding of what's going on. Now, to be honest, like, I haven't put as much work into the newsletter as I was hoping for when I started, so it's not meeting the goal right now. I do have to be honest about that. But in terms of sort of what I have done, so the first one, I sort of defined what the Israel lobby is, who it consists of, and what it does, just to give a really concrete definition and examples of the term, because people could use it in different ways. The next one, I did a short profile of HRC, you know, if, in case people don't really know who they are, providing more information. I talked a bit in the next one about what it was like when HRC put out like an action alert or whatever they call it about me. And then in the most recent one, I talked about an example, or actually a couple of examples from the Toronto Star that kind of gone under the radar, of them basically replacing the word Palestine in an article and sort of making some pretty egregious and patronizing changes to the article as a result. So hopefully I'll be able to do more of these sort of update type things in the future, but I can't promise it.
Well, I hope you do, because it, again, no one else is writing about it. So we need someone to do it. And is, you know, the Toronto Star article recently where they took out the word Palestine, replaced it with Palestinians. I think that's a good example.
Thanks for this work that you do, Davida. It's great. And you're also, of course, your work at The Passage, we mentioned at the top of the podcast, is important. And I wonder if listeners are interested, Davida published an op-ed earlier this month, following with members of parliament and about the investigation into Shireen Abu Akleh's death. We really appreciate your work on this. You're doing some work that very few other people are doing, and you're on the front line. So thank you for your efforts in this area.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. Thanks to all our supporters who helped to make this podcast and all of our activities possible. Thanks to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. And we'll look forward to having you with us at our next podcast episode, not too long from now. Take care. See you all again soon.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free...
The following is a previously broadcast program.
I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy. I can do what I want. I'm a big
if
girl.
They don't pay your bills, pay them no mind. Move on to the friend. If you wasting time, he calling again, then bitch, he decline. Cause when they forget, then you must remind. Such a big deal, ahead of his time. I keep it on chill, a hint of that lime. I'm in the field, most of the time. Lord, head of the ghetto, they must have a shrine. Hallelujah, what it do, yeah. If you want it, gotta bust a move, yeah. If they offer one, tell them two, yeah. Baby, make them play by your rules, yeah. I'm con, straight like that, with a little bit of stunt. Cartier frames, let me see what I want. Right there in concrete, mixed in a blunt. If you got a problem, we can take it out front.
That's my pussy, I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy, I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy, I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now. That's my pussy, I can do what I want. I'm a big girl now.
Peter Brax.
That's my pussy, I can do what I want.
Nia loves you, baby girl.
That's my pussy, I can do what I want. I'm a big girl.
That's
my pussy, I can do what I want.
We gonna take this round the world.
That's my pussy, I can do what I want. I'm a big girl.
A good thing all up in his face, but I ain't got no time to waste. The only thing that keep me safe is my safe. The bank is the only thing I'll ever chase. A love I never can replace. Speaking of, I'ma need you to pay me like you're paying him. Might put that word on my Tim's. I just been one of my rims, so you know I need them ends. Plus these baby need pampers, more hunts for the dancers. And if she give you a shot, then you better romance her. Straight shooter on the